From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. You may have missed this amid all the headlines recently, but, you know, Siberia is on fire.
What's been going on in Siberia, in the northern Siberia towards the Arctic Circle, has been crazy. It's been so unusually warm, it's ridiculous.
Emergency crews in northern Russia are using explosives to put out nearly 300 fires. Unusually warm weather has helped fires break out across Siberia.
This is not Santa Cruz, this is Siberia.
An extraordinary heat wave is having its way with one of the coldest regions on Earth, and with it, a dramatically altered ecology, melting ice sheets, spewing of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. All in all, the latest alarming news from the biggest story in the history of the planet. Amid pandemic, social revolution, and an outlaw administration, this latest unthinkable environment catastrophe flashed for an instant and promptly disappeared from the news. Why? Why are humans and the subset of humanity called the media still subordinating the destruction of planet Earth as a vague and distant threat? Well, obviously, part of the answer is the immediate threat, COVID-19, a plague infecting the entire globe right now. But coronavirus has its own odd psychology. The notion that one way or another, in a reasonable amount of time, whether by vaccine or by its own natural life cycle, the pandemic will soon enough be behind us. Kids in school in Orange County after Labor Day? Why not? Opening up the economy? Normal campus life? Pro sports? Just around the corner.
Easter is our timeline. What a great timeline that would be.
This virus, the good news is it'll be over by summer.
But what if cellular prosperity is not right around the corner? How often is that very real possibility ever top of mind? David Roberts writes about energy policy at Vox. He's written about the mental phenomenon of shifting baselines, in which we calibrate our expectations to the world we were born into, irrespective of what came before, and in so doing, underestimate the severity of threats to our well-being. The term first emerged in 1995 when fisheries scientist Daniel Pauly observed that each generation of fisheries scientists accepts as a baseline the number of fish and the species composition at the beginning of their careers and uses that baseline to evaluate changes.
Say if you live in the American Southwest and you're, I don't know, 18 today and you're sort of just aware of the weather around you and the world around you, someone can tell you, we didn't used to have, you know, 15 days above 100 degrees every year. We didn't used to have 2 or 3 days a year where you literally have to stay inside to avoid dangerous heat. But to you, whatever you find feels normal. And similarly to the next generation, it'll be a little hotter for the next generation, but that will feel normal to them.
Now, what you're describing is something called generational amnesia. But I am old enough to remember 50 years ago. And researchers have shown that hot summers through much of the United States are 200 times more likely than they were 50 years ago. And by hot summers, I mean very high average temperatures, warnings not to go outside, and so forth. Well, 50 years ago, I was 15 running around in summer. And nonetheless, even though I myself am awash in, you know, climate health alarm, to me, going outside and it's 96 degrees just feels like summer.
Basically, what psychologists have found is you have a window of like 2 to 10 years of your recent experience that you will benchmark as normal. And so if the summers are very slowly and incrementally changing, your baseline of what's normal is also slowly and incrementally changing. They've done studies about Londoners during the Blitz, right? You would think that bombs falling randomly on your city for months on end would just be something that feels intrinsically unusual. But the Blitz went on for long enough that people basically adjusted and more or less led lives that they thought were sort of modest and normal and happy while bombs were falling on London. So, like, even that you can adjust to. So, you know, I look at that and I think, well, what is climate change ever going to do that's going to match the London Blitz?
Or the civil war in Lebanon, or the siege of Sarajevo. And right now we're in the siege of Sarajevo. It's called COVID-19. You know, I was talking about adapting to hot summers. Only 5 months has elapsed.
Yes, if you went back 5 months and explained to someone what it would be like now, that would feel alarming because it's a jump. But instead, we've just sort of backed our way into this incrementally, like, oh, we got to stay home. Oh, we got to wear masks. Oh, school is going to be half at home. Just like things are so unusual and crazy, but already we're getting used to it. I think the real key distinction here, and this is what the psychologists all told me, is we can get used to anything as long as it's consistent. The reason we haven't totally adjusted ourselves already to this pandemic is that there hasn't been any consistency. We keep getting new information, new questions. The administration keeps taking new lines and asserting new things. And so it's really uncertainty and ambiguity that humans hate above all else. If the grinding, stay at home, come to work in shifts, go to school in shifts, if all that becomes kind of our consistent reality, we will very quickly lose even what level of panic and outrage we have today. I hate to say it because I worry like someone in the Trump administration might hear it, but if you want people to get used to something, that's what you have to focus on. It doesn't matter if circumstances are bad, as long as they are consistent over time.
So you can plan your day tomorrow.
Exactly.
All of these responses in the aggregate constitute something they call the psychological immune system. How does that work?
Yeah, this is one of the most interesting and consistent, actually, findings in modern psychology, is if you ask people, what would it do to your happiness if you had a car accident and lost a leg, right? Something like that. People intuitively will think, well, I'll be less happy. And similarly, if you ask, what would happen if you won the lottery? People think, well, that would, in an enduring way, make me happier. And it turns out that we basically have, each of us, something like a happiness set point, a natural equilibrium based on our brain chemistry and experiences and whatever else. And we generally will return to that set point. Our immune system sort of like neutralizes these big new events into normality, right? So the person who loses a leg and the person who wins the lottery will, a year after those events, be roughly as happy as they were before. Your psychological immune system quickly absorbs new experiences, rationalizes them, makes sense of them in the world, and you return to your set point.
It would seem that it's antithetical to action to deal with chronic problems.
Right. This is the paradox we keep returning to over and over again in modern society, is our evolved cognitive and emotional machinery is built to respond to events that are proximate to us in our immediate circumstances. We're just not built to think about, or much less to sort of emotionally react to, these longer term incremental changes. So we have to do all the work with our heads. If you tell me Arctic ice has been incrementally reducing for 20 years, I can say, yes, I know that, but it takes some real work on my part to feel that in any kind of way. It takes some work to translate what we know into the emotion that's required to respond to it. It's emotions that motivate us to action, not facts.
These phenomena you're describing also apply to our economic dire straits, to the disappearance of local news, the normalization of toxic politics and so-called alternate truth. There's a lot of chaos, perversity, depravity that we've just kind of accepted.
If you told someone in 2015 how the U.S. president would be behaving today, it would absolutely strike them as ludicrous and crazy and worth mobilizing to stop. But instead, we've just lived through this kind of incremental loss of norms and standards, such that now Trump can do stuff on a daily basis that barely even makes us blink anymore. Like stuff that would have been absolutely a scandal and impeachable not very long ago, we've already normalized it. And this raises a really interesting thing. one of the things that leaders can do through their sort of rhetoric and their example is make something that we are taking as normal and kind of lift it up and make us look at it from a different perspective and make us see it as anomalous and bad.
What part can journalists play in contextualizing these outlier events and making them seem less inevitable and create an environment where society addresses them and tries to intervene?
Well, I mean, I think the honest answer is I don't really know. I mean, there are individual media projects, like the one I mentioned in my post is this journalist, John Sutter, who's going to go visit these places that are being affected by climate change every 5 years through 2050. The idea is just maybe if we can see with our eyes the changes over time, they'll be more salient to us. And that's really interesting, and maybe it will work. But ultimately, what you need in media is kind of the same what you need in politics, which is leadership. If media is entirely driven by what gets clicks, it's always going to be the short term. That's where the outrage lives. To pull the lens back and show the longer view and the bigger view takes some leadership. And in media, we used to call that gatekeeping, right? And notoriously now, there are no gates anymore. So who is the agent in media who would push back against and say, okay, we're going to sacrifice some short-term clicks and ad revenue to kind of pull the lens back and try to emphasize this longer view? And it seems like the media is getting carried along in the short-termism as bad or worse than any other person or institution around us.
Well, you know, I must say, John Sutter sounds like the most cockeyed optimist on earth. Do you think that anyone's going to be around to take the pictures in 2050?
Well, yes, there will be people. And the crazy thing is, they will feel like they're living in a normal time too, right? I mean, as crazy as it is, there'll be more storms, there'll be more heat waves. These pandemics might be as frequent as the seasonal flu. This is a danger someone raised in my article. We could just start thinking, oh, it's winter, time for us all to go indoors, see you on Zoom until June. As crazy as it seems to us now, you can absolutely imagine people getting used to that. You can imagine people in 2050, we would think, oh, that world looks chaotic and dangerous. There's all these migrations of climate refugees, and my God, there's heat waves killing thousands of people. But to those people, we will have gotten there through these incremental stair-step changes that just get incorporated. And by the time they live there, to the people who are becoming adults in 2050, that's normal.
We have spent this whole conversation discussing the human ability, evidently the product of evolutionary adaptation, to be blind to the threat right in front of us. Is there any part of that psychology that also makes us blind to progress?
Yes, in the exact same way, incremental moves in a positive direction also get kind of ignored and incorporated. And just as big losses don't strike us as big losses, often big wins don't strike us as big wins. So for instance, you know, you look at the number of women and girls in the developing world who are getting an education. For the last decades or two, that number has been rising and rising, but it just rises slowly enough that no one ever stops and thinks of that as a giant and notable victory. It's incremental in the exact same way. So
infant mortality, per capita income.
Yeah, there's a lot of social indicators that are moving in the right direction, but we're not chalking them up as giant victories for the same reason. We're just sort of incorporating them. Also, one of the things I think leadership and good media can do, in addition to making us aware of these long-term threats, it can also make us aware that it is possible to move in the other direction. And so if we draw more attention to those victories, I think it can help people conceive of winning against these dire threats.
David, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
David Roberts writes about energy and politics for Vox. Coming up, dating apps and turn-by-turn road directions. We have the technology. Getting COVID test results to public health officials? Not so much. This is On the Media.